Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next, you need the team to act on feedback fast. So you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/retro now for a free business plan trial to unlock advanced retro tools like private mode, voting, and two-way Jira syncing. That's Miro.com/retro now.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm going to be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the stories making the news here in Ireland and around the world. First off, I want to say thank you to everyone who got in contact with us about last week's show, which was an election special. We do appreciate your comments and hopefully that's something we can return to in the future when there are more elections happening elsewhere around the world. Coming up on today's show, though, we have economist Dan O'Brien. He's going to be joined by John Downing from the Irish Independent. And we're going to be discussing exactly how much the government have in its coffers and how much they're going to be offering you to tempt you in the next general election. And then on a slightly Gaelic feel, we're going to turn our attention to France, because last week Emmanuel Macron stunned the political landscape by announcing parliamentary elections, and he did so just about as they're about to host the Olympic Games. So today we're going to talk to John Litchfield about why Emmanuel Macron has done that, and we're also going to be looking at big games and the economy of big games and why countries do those big games and how they can benefit economically from them. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Well, for our first item today, the summer of sport has begun in earnest. Already this week, we've had athletics from Rome and the football, the European Championships beginning in Germany, and all roads, of course, leading to Paris and the Olympics at the end of July. So the question that I wanted to ask today is, holding those large scale events actually worth it from an economic perspective? Well, this is a debate in academia that has been rolling around for quite some time and looking at the potential positive and negative effects. And Ivan Savan, who's Associate Professor of Quantitative Analytics at the ESCP Business School, has been looking at it and he joins me on the line now. Ivan, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you very much, Mandy.
You've written a very interesting article about this, looking at the issue and some research you've done. But maybe let's start off with the motivation around hosting a large scale event such as the Olympics or the European Championships. What is a country or indeed a national capital city hoping to achieve by hosting and holding one of these type of tournaments?
To my knowledge, the motivation can be quite different. Some countries want to increase their visibility and reputation. Some countries want to develop their infrastructure better by organizing events, this large-scale sport event in a particular place. Some countries may have a mix of this motivation, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, before they even get started and actually hold the events, there's quite a lot of work to do, like investment in infrastructure, as you mentioned there. Can you just talk us through what that might entail and maybe the negatives around those? Of course, they're left with nice stadia to use, but to what end?
So it's true that countries need to typically invest a lot of money in large-scale sport events, and it depends to a certain extent how developed the infrastructure already is. Sometimes it's, let's say, renewing infrastructure, and sometimes it's really building it from scratch. This is why budget of certain countries in organizing large-scale sport events was in tens of billions of dollars, like Beijing in 2008, Russia in Sochi in 2014, and particularly Qatar a couple of years ago for the World Cup. And apart from building the stadiums themselves, of course, they have to build a lot of additional infrastructure, restaurants, hotels, roads. It's all typically takes a lot of money and a lot of time, which creates like a continuous construction in process for several years in these places. And on a positive side, like I said, the advantage is that you build a lot of modern infrastructure, you aim to attract tourists, and this is one of the, let's say, arguments policymakers try to advance when they say it's good to organize Olympics. And they also potentially want to stimulate some entrepreneurship because there will be some economy growth potentially on the place when the large-scale sport event takes place.
Mm.
On the negative side, however, not only during the event, but due to construction before that, people who live in this place will experience a lot of traffic problems because it will be either under construction or very heavy use. There will be potentially increased prices of all kinds of services because new infrastructure is expensive to use and start implementation. There will be a lot of pollution, noise, potentially environmental detrimental effects. And on top of that, because you need to build all this infrastructure, it also creates a heavy burden on the budget of the country and potentially increasing taxes.
You mentioned there Qatar, actually. They were an interesting one when they were hosting the World Cup a couple of years ago. They had heavily invested in infrastructure, and part of all of this at the time was enhancing their global reputation. But actually, they came under a lot of scrutiny that may not necessarily have happened were they not to be hosting an event like that. And you'll recall there was lots of claims about, you know, sports washing and terrible atrocities that were happening in the building sector and how they were exploiting workers. So reputationally, before that even got off the ground, there were very difficult issues that they had to deal with. Leading into these big tournaments and games, that's a big effort, isn't it, for them to manage the process of before they ever get to host the game?
No, of course. It's a lot of effort to win the competition, a lot of effort to promote it. And as I said, it's basically a motivation to increase your visibility and reputation, but there is no guarantee for sure. For example, in the case of Brazil, which organized over the last two decades Olympics and World Cup relatively close to each other, they also faced a lot of criticism in media globally on, let's say, on the issue of criminality, poverty in the country. They were expecting to increase reputation, but in fact, some of the studies were arguing that decreasing numbers in terms of tourist inflow was largely due to negative image that the country received in media around these same years.
Mm. Then, look, turning to the positives, because there's lots of positives. You get to showcase your country and your capital and a lot of other cities sometimes around the world. So maybe take us through what the effects on things like tourism can be after an event like the European Championships or the Olympics.
A positive image can be actually positive reputation about the country and how welcoming, warm the country is. There were some indication that World Cup in Germany in 2006 was very positive in terms of the media image of the country, that Germans are not so cold as some people tend to think they are, for example. There may be some important positives that the infrastructure that will be constructed for the mega event can receive a lot of attention and use after the event and used in a very constructive way. A big country like, for example, China and organizing Olympics in Beijing certainly can utilize the infrastructure in their capital. I could give a different example. In 2008, Austria and Switzerland organized EuroCup, right? And as it's typically the case, the games have been taking place in different places. And one of the hosting cities was Klagenfurt. It's a very small town, 100,000 inhabitants on the border with Slovenia. I've been to Klagenfurt myself. I have some friends there. And I remember they telling that the region has a big difficulty understanding what to do with the stadium. Because when the event is over and it was too big for the place, and the cost of maintaining it is simply too large.
And what about tourism in places like this while the event is on? Sometimes you look at these events and think, oh my God, it's going to be very difficult to A, get tickets, or B, get around a city that's, you know, jam-packed with other sports fans. So what, in your analysis, what did you find about the tourism during the events?
So tourism during the event, in terms of, let's say, visitors coming to attend specifically the cities, the games, is most of the time successful, unless it's really like some failure story. The problem is, what I was doing in my research, I was comparing not just the number of tourists which come specifically for the Olympics or World Cup, but the overall inflow of tourists on the year of the event and 3 years after. So basically to consider if there is a crowding in or crowding out effect with so-called regular tourists, which would have gone to visit the country for other reasons. And so the main findings that we obtained is that it's very few events over the last couple of decades of this large-scale events, which is Winter, Summer Olympics and World Cup, where you actually had a net inflow of tourists overall. It was the case of World Cup in Japan, South Korea. It was the case for World Cup in South Africa. It was Summer Olympics in China and Winter Olympics in Russia. All the rest was either neutral, so no gain, or negative.
Wow, that's very interesting, because you would typically think that after an event like that, people see the best of the country and go, you know, actually substantially increase the numbers. But did you find any difference in cities that are already, say, tourist attractions? So say someone like London, where people automatically go to, they don't really need any more tourism. What did the Olympic Games do for them, or did it change the amount of visitors to London at that time or the 3 years afterwards?
London, in case it was in our sample, was definitely not the case where the inflow was positive specifically. And like I said, because we had over the last, let's say, 2 to 3 decades, several places when it was organized in Europe or North America, those cases were typically neutral or negative. So one of our conclusions that we make in the paper is that, like you said, if a country, if a, particularly the city, already has a positive image, reputation, and regular inflow of tourists, for these places, it's typically actually harder to avoid crowding out effect, just because you already have a considerable base on which you are building upon in terms of tourists. And it means that you have a bigger challenge, that you need to maintain those people, but attract new ones. An example of South Africa is different for two reasons. First, it's probably, compared to, let's say, Europe, US, far not as attractive and popular place still to go. And second, they organized World Cup in the off season when it was winter there, which additionally boosted inflow of tourists, for example.
That's another question I wanted to ask, was about the difference between winter and summer events. Is there any kind of distinction that you've found between those two?
Not dramatically, no. Of course, when we were doing analysis, we were taking into account the timing of the event, whether it's winter or summer. But we had several Winter Olympics in the sample and several Summer Olympics. And most of them, both for summer and winter, have been found to be neutral or negative. So it's actually quite a few examples. There is another illustration which has also seen some support in studies that have been conducted before us. For example, Greece, 2004, they also organized Euro Cup. And there have been several, reports and also scholarly studies demonstrating that while the event in itself was a success in terms of, yes, many people came, they enjoyed the Euro Cup, the prices of staying and visiting the country during this period jumped a lot. And it has been, what has been registered is that regular tourists during that time, which tended to go to Greece, decided to go to their competitive locations, Turkey, Italy, let's say, places with a similar, let's say, location and climate, but without that big queues and high prices.
Mm. So, Ivan, it just seems talking to you that it doesn't really affect in a positive way those destinations which are already getting tourists to them. But when you're looking at places like maybe when Japan hosted the World Cup or South Korea in 2002, they do actually attract more than they would have hoped for. So maybe people look at this and think, actually, visiting a place I might not normally visit and building in something that is structured like a sports tournament is a good idea.
I think so. This was, in a way, one of our major conclusions, is that if you organize an event, a big, large-scale event in one place, then to hope, at, because we were focusing at least in our work specifically on tourists, we didn't look in detail on the cost of use infrastructure before, after. Mm-hmm. But talking just about tourists, it is a big ease for the hosting country if it has relatively low start, low base, because then there is less of a challenge of a crowding out effect. And then you are basically concentrating just to demonstrate your openness, developing the infrastructure and using it subsequently. So most of our positive examples, like I listed, were Asia and Africa, not Europe and the US.
Mm. Ivan, as we all kind of approach the Paris Olympics now, listening to what you've said there, it sounds like obviously Paris doesn't need any more tourists. It's doing quite okay every year on that front. How do you think they'll manage it? It'll be a huge spectacle for the French people who love the style and the pomp and the ceremony and everything the Olympics will bring with it.
Well, first of all, I really hope the event goes well, successfully, peacefully, at all, and it will be positive for the country image, of course. It's also quite close to where I live myself, so for me it's also a positive spillover, so to speak. I have some doubts how, let's say, positive the tourist inflow for the city will be and for the country overall this year and the couple of years that will go, because I personally work in a French, basically, business school, even so I'm located in Madrid. So I have many colleagues who work and live in Paris. Mm. And I heard from them, so it's not like one, two, it's dozens of people who try to avoid staying over summer in Paris and avoid visiting it, let's say, for business or particularly leisure. Mm. During this time, because it becomes so overcrowded and difficult, let's say, to organize. It's already now quite difficult with all the international events that are taking place in the city. But let's see. And until we will see the data, I would prefer to avoid making strong conclusions.
And just enjoy the games while you watch it.
Of course.
Ivan, your analysis was fascinating and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. That was Ivan Savan, who is Associate Professor of Quantitative Analytics at the ESCP Business School. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ivan.
Thank you very much, Mandy.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we'll discuss Emmanuel Macron's surprising decision to call an election and what it might mean for the far right and their chances at gaining political power in Europe. Please stay tuned.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/diagram now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more features like advanced shapes, dependency mapping, and two-way Jira syncing. Get started today at Miro.com/diagram now.
You welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. Now, it was swift and it was shocking. As soon as it became clear that Marine Le Pen, the far-right National Rally Party, had made massive gains in the European elections, well, President Macron surprised both France and Europe by calling parliamentary elections for later this month. Will this lance the boil that is the French far-right, or will it be a stunning old goal by Macron? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by the doyen of French political commentators, John Litchfield, to try and make sense of all this. John, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Well, I'm very pleased to be with you.
John, like, if you're trying to assess what's happening in Europe and in terms of the relationship with the far right, you can't get any more complex or acute example than what's happening in France today. Before we get into the whys and wherefores, you've written a brilliant opinion piece in Politico this week about it. Can you just give me what you think his motivations were for doing this right now?
Yeah, it's been a subject of great speculation amongst the French, with hundreds of theories and conspiracy theories. I think in the end, it was quite simple. You know, Macron, rightly and wrongly, and sometimes wrongly, is a man that likes to be in charge of the timetable. You know, he doesn't like to be being told what to do. He wanted to be on the front foot. And he knew, I think, he knew that he was going to face a drubbing in the European elections last Sunday. So he got together with a very small group of people. Not even his prime minister knew what was going on. And they decided that the best way to respond to this was to attack rather than to defend or hide and to call an election. I think he thought that the European election had been a referendum on him and his unpopularity after 7 years in power, which was true, and that he could therefore turn things around by making this national election something that affected people directly, where people knew that their vote was going to affect the way the country was run in the next few years. He could turn that around and make it a referendum on the far right, on Marine Le Pen and her deputy Jordan Bardella, who ran in the European campaign, and ask the French people, as he did, actually formally ask the French people at his press conference today, do you really want to be run by the far right? Mm. You know, it's just a good question. But I'm not sure he's necessarily going to get the answer he wanted. The polls are not good for him at the moment. His party's struggling at about the same level it was in the European elections. What is interesting, though, is that the left is rising very strongly. And so it's not absolutely certain by any means that the far right is going to get an overall majority or even a big enough number of MPs to pretend to take over power after July 7th. So it's absolutely a confusion in every way at the moment, French politics.
Mm. But, it's a massive gamble if that's what he's doing. He's putting it up to the French people to say, look, I actually don't want the far right. We want the centre to hold. He doesn't know whether that's going to be the response that he gets. But you think that these elections are very pivotal and could even be the equivalent of a Brexit moment for France?
Yeah, in fact, you know, a Brexit moment in the sense that Marine Le Pen's party used to be in favour of Frexit, of France leaving the EU and of leaving the euro. She now says she's not in favour of that, but she says she's going to train to pursue policies towards the EU that would be, in effect, leaving while staying in. You know, she'd be a bit like a Viktor Orban on a bigger scale, disobeying the rules, not paying all the fees, not paying all the money to Europe, and essentially trying to disrupt and destroy the EU as it's come to be from the inside. And now, you know, France is in some ways, or absolutely in all ways, a much more elemental part of the EU than Britain. I mean, Britain's leaving has weakened the EU. You can't say anything different to that. It's been a great shock. And the British are missed in many ways, and the British themselves miss the EU, though they didn't want to admit that. But France leaving would be elemental. It would be mortal for the EU, I think, especially since there are not leaving even, but trying to destroy it from the inside, especially as there is a rise of far-right parties in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in other places, that in Italy, slightly differently, which take a similar view. So, you know, Le Pen's party in power would be potentially the beginning of the complete unravelling of the EU.
Mm. Beyond his own shores, though, is this real fear that German Franco power base that we've witnessed over decades is really weakening, and that they're seeing a kind of reordering where countries, as you mentioned there, like Italy and maybe even Hungary, are starting to assert their power and sharpen their elbows in a EU political, in a different way, in a more assertive a way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I would add Poland as well. I think Poland under Donald Tusk, they before took a sort of Hungarian view and sort of took the money but didn't want to obey the rules. I think Poland under Tusk is going to be a very active and big power in the EU. Italy already beginning to influence things in not entirely negative way. She's taken the Giorgia Meloni has not taken as destructive a view as Marine Le Pen plans to do or seems to plan to do. So, yeah, I think you're right. The Franco-German axis, the Franco-German partnership, they don't get on. Partly the two countries have a lot of things to quarrel about, and the two present leaders are very, very different characters and don't get on. Germany and France are no longer so central to the chemistry, to the mechanics of the EU as they were a few years ago.
I just want to touch on something that you said at the beginning when I asked you what you thought the motivations were. And you said that Macron just cannot be seen to be on the back foot, and that he wants to be in charge and he wants to be proactive and taking control of the situation. It does speak to his, I don't know whether you'd call it arrogance or vanity or something like that. But we should also consider that the French, as a nation, love their style and love the spectacle. And the upcoming Olympics were a way to assert their ownership of both of those, I think, on a global stage. The mayor there, Anne Hidalgo, and her efforts to make sure that happened, has he compromised those?
The timing is bizarre for many reasons. The Paris Olympics is one of them. Summer is not a good time to have elections in France. Everyone thought, and this is another reason why he's perhaps gone for it now, everyone thought, or even almost knew, that there was going to have to be early elections this year, more likely in September, October. The reason being that he had to get the next year's budget through, and it was clear that having struggled to get it through in previous years, he was going to almost certainly face and lose a number of censure motions in the National Assembly in the autumn. And, the result in the European elections was likely to sort of embolden the opposition parties to go for him go after him in that way. So I think he decided to bring the whole thing forward, try and shock the other parties because they weren't ready. He hoped that by doing it as quickly as this, and he took the shortest possible time for an election. He could have had 40 days, but he chose only 21 days for the first round. And I think he was then hoping to sort of catch off balance, especially the very divided left parties whose alliance that they fought the last election was seemed to have fallen apart. And it seems more to have taken by surprise his own camp than the far right or the left, frankly. I think that was a miscalculation, if that was part of his calculation.
Yeah, logistics obviously a huge part of any campaign, and questioning again how ready he and his party are for all of this. It all has a very lastminute.com feel about it. I don't know whether he's in danger of becoming a kind of Gallic Rishi Sunak now at this point. But maybe the issues in the campaign, how has he performed on things like the economy and immigration, and how does he go into these elections on those kind of issues?
Macron is disliked in France. I mean, people admire him a lot abroad. He's been internationally made France's voice count, and you can say many positive things, I think, about France, about Macron as an international leader. Within France, I don't think his record is as bad as the French think. He's brought unemployment down for the first time in many years. He had started to try and cure the deficit before the COVID epidemic came along, and he splashed the cash on that, as many other countries did, but never managed to get it sorted out since, and so the deficit has exploded. His record in France on things like security and immigration are attacked, but, that's a problem for all countries. I'm not sure that France is doing more disastrously than other countries on those issues. In fact, the far right goes on and on about violence in France, but if you look at the figures, France is not a violent country. It was more violent 20 or 30 years ago in some respects. The number of murders, for instance, in France now is less than it was in the 60s and 70s. But that's not the way it's seen. The far right has successfully created this drumbeat, and for every single time anyone is hurt or killed in France, it's sort of headline news, and somehow the government is to blame. So he's lost control of the narrative. That's the truth, and in politics is a very dangerous thing to do. Beyond that, you have to say that the French pretty well always hate their leaders. François Hollande, the last president, was in single-figure approval ratings at one point. Macron was only in the low 30s, I think, or maybe high 20s on his worst days. So it's a fact that to be a popular politician in France, you have to be up and coming, retired or dead, basically. Jacques Chirac, now he's no longer with us in this world, is an extremely popular figure. He was very popular when he was retired, but he was sort of regarded as either a figure of fun or a sort of wicked man when he was in power. So Macron is suffering from that. He's also suffering from the fact that he is a centrist. You know, he isn't someone who has a power base in one of the sort of traditional left or right areas of French political discourse, nor in the media either. There are left-wing medias and right-wing media in France. There's not much in the way of centrist media. And so Macron rarely gets a very positive write-up in the French media, and it's the job of the media to criticize. But I think they very rarely give him credit for what he does well, and they always bash him for everything he does wrong. So, yeah, he's 7 years in power in France. It's a long time to survive. He's the first president to have had a second term in that way, apart from Chirac, which is a bit of an accident because Le Pen got into the second round of the presidential election for many, many decades. So he is, he had come to the end of the road, really, but he's still going to be president, even if he loses this election. He's going to have 3 more years in the Elysee Palace. People are saying he might resign if he loses clearly this election to the far right. He said the other day that was absurd. He would not do that, and I don't think he would. I think he would stay and try and somehow, as far as he can, and he does have separate powers as president, especially over foreign and defence and European issues, disputed just how much, but he does, by tradition in French life, have direct powers over those. He would try and to hold back the tide of far-right changes as long as he could.
And if he did lose those parliamentary elections, so what would he cede power on? What would he not be able to control?
People think that France is a presidential system. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it is, because, you know, the president, if he's in the same political family as the prime minister, if he has a majority in parliament, is the more senior figure. But essentially, the way the constitution is written, the power is really with the parliament and with the prime minister. And so if the president is of a different political persuasion and the prime minister is trying to do something quite different to what the president wants, he can do so on all domestic policy. You know, the parliament finally has the power and the president doesn't. So if Macron has to go into what the French call cohabitation with the cohabitation with the far right or with the left, potentially, he would not have any say. He could try and hold things back, but he could not stop them passing domestic policies on laws that they wanted, on defence, on Europe, on foreign affairs. He would have more, potentially more control, but the actual degree of his control is disputed.
Fascinating, because in the past, as you say, it has happened before, but maybe not with such extreme views on both sides.
That's a very good point, because on 3 occasions you had Mitterrand, a socialist president with a centre-right prime minister. Then you had a centre-right president, Chirac, with a left-wing prime minister. But, you know, and they disagreed on many things. You know, Jospin introduced a 35-hour week in France when Chirac was president, and he was totally opposed to it. But on the big, big issues of Europe, foreign affairs, of, you know, the basic structure of French society and attitudes to immigration, that kind of thing, the ideological differences between the centre-left and the centre-right in those days was not so great. And so they agreed on many things, and those cohabitations, although there were tensions at times, obviously there were, but essentially they passed off reasonably, peacefully and well. And as you say, this will be quite different. You'll have people of totally ideologically different persuasions, potentially in the Elysee Palace and the Matignon, the Prime Minister's residence, which would not be Le Pen if she gets a majority. She has said that her very young number two, Jordan Bardella, who's only 28, never been anything but a political operative in his life, will be the prime minister if she gets a majority in 3 or 4 weeks' time. So you then have the extraordinary vision of Macron going to EU summits accompanied by this young man who doesn't believe in Europe, who's completely opposed to the EU, although they don't quite say it that way, but he is. and who has pretty extreme views on things like immigration and race.
Yeah, absolutely.
Utterly opposed to Macron's point of view.
Yeah.
Very odd couple indeed, if that happens.
Potentially extraordinary. John, before I let you go, and very briefly, I could stay and talk to you for hours. I've been reading you for years. Just call it for me. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I've been trying to work that one out myself. Do you know, what is happening and what is interesting is that it's not going the way Macron thought. It may change yet. But if you look at the way the polls are moving, the far right vote is coming down a little bit, and the left combined left vote is going up. And they're only about, I think the far right is now about 31%, but the combined left is now at about 26, 27, 28%. Macron's party at about 18%. So it's possible if that. France has been divided three ways between left, right and centre since Macron came to power. It's possible that Macron centre is going to be squeezed by the left and the right, but not the old centre-left and centre-right, by a very much more radical right and a very much more radical left. And then it's not impossible that you know, there will be no clear majority in the new assembly, and Macron will have to choose what he can out of that mess. And you can just imagine possibly him trying to put together some sort of majority out of the left, out of the centre, out of the more moderate part of the right. And I imagine he would probably have to seek a kind of non-political prime minister, some figure, I'm not sure who that would be, who could run the country for a while, with an agenda that was agreed by those parties. But with Macron taking more of a backward seat, I think that would have to be the condition of the others allowing that Macron would obviously be there for foreign defence, European, all those things that he's, as president, entitled to be. But I think he would have to take a much more detached view on domestic policy and let whoever this prime minister would be take control of the country and try and keep the country on its rails. But, you know, that is my sort of speculation, really. That's about the most positive outcome I can now imagine. The idea of Macron's party winning another majority is now for the birds, I think.
Well, John, I appreciate that you didn't even try to dodge the question. That's very good of you. But thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. A bit to go on this yet. That was John Litchfield, seasoned commentator on French politics. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up next, in light of last week's elections, how significant are the Exchequer returns and how much did the government have in their coffers? Stay tuned as we're joined by economist Dan O'Brien and John.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. In Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. In Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/brainstorm now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more brainstorming tools like private mode and voting. That's Miro.com/brainstorm now.
On Downing. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, they got slightly overlooked last week, but the Exchequer figures came out, and in those figures, corporate tax receipts rose by a whopping 30% in May. It boosted the government's financial position ahead of the budget and allayed a lot of fears that 2024 might see some kind of economic downturn. What are the political and economic implications for this? And do these returns actually strengthen the government's position as they head into a general election, potentially in the next couple of months? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by John Downing, who is political columnist with the Irish Independent and former government press secretary with the Green Party. And also on the line is Dan O'Brien, who's chief economist with the Institute for International and European Affairs. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome. Dan, I'm going to start off with you, please, about those figures, because I think they did go under the radar a lot last week just because of the elections and our obsession with all of those things. But they revealed that the government collected $35.2 billion in taxes during the first 5 months of the year, which is 6% or 2 billion more than the same period last year. What do you put that down to?
Well, there's a number of factors, Matty. One is just inflation. So a lot of that's a headline figure, and obviously we've got a bit of inflation now. So, you know, half of that's being caused by inflation. We have a lot more people working. So if anything, I would have thought we should be doing better than that. Now, there have been some tax cuts in the budget, and that might have explained it. But these figures aren't all that strong. We've had incredible growth in revenue over the past 10 years, double the EU average for compared to other governments. Hmm. But more recently, there's been a slowdown. And you mentioned the corporation tax in your intro there. And you're absolutely correct. In May, compared to May last year, there was a bump. But earlier this year, the worries, it actually fell back in some months. So far this year, in the first 5 months, it's more or less what it was last year. So that really huge surge in corporation tax receipts that we saw in recent years has stabilized. Now, thankfully, it's stabilized rather than fallen back. But there's a big worry. Nobody really knows what's going on there. And the big worry is that it will fall back to more normal levels rather than either stabilizing or staying the same. So we have a big vulnerability around that, you know, anyone, all of your listeners, I'm sure, is pretty familiar with.
Mm. So, Dan, listening to you there now, what's your assessment as we head in toward that kind of general election cycle in terms of what's going to be in the coffers for the government to spend? Because, you know, there is this thinking that they're not going to do what they did the last time when Pascal Donoghue was very restrained, and all roads seem to be leading toward a bumper budget, which I'm going to talk to John about in a minute and what the parties might be promising. But from your take on this, how solid will the government coffers be going into that election?
As I say, you know, look, we've had this huge increase in revenue over the past 10 years. Despite that, we still have almost a quarter of a trillion in government debt. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that's, you know, something that's going to cause a major problem today or tomorrow. But, you know, we saw with Liz Truss in the UK, a G7 economy, that, you know, you take a misstep and things can go pretty badly wrong pretty quickly. Now, you know, we know from our own, going through the Irish state going bust in 2010, you know, that things can go wrong. Things do go wrong. So, you know, I am slightly concerned that we're getting into this kind of the sense that we had back in 2005, 6, 7, that we were bulletproof and we can do whatever we want and we can spend whatever we want and everything is going to be fine. You know, neither the fundamentals of the public finances are as solid as sometimes, you know, the national conversation appears to suggest. And there's also this issue of the vulnerabilities and the risks, be it corporation tax, be it something coming out of the blue like a war. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the world that's unstable right now.
Mm. John, the economy, our budget might not be as fundamentally sound as politicians would have you believe. Do you think there's any possibility that these will listen to the restraints called for by Dan and indeed the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, again calling on the government to be prudent and responsible as they move forward?
I think the short answer and the definitive answer is no. It's an election where one way or another, you may want to come back to election timing, but anyway you look at it, it's a maximum 9 months away. This budget is the one. The upcoming budget this autumn, and before a general election, this government will want to be generous in order to win votes. And there's a thing which you increasingly pick up on the corridors, where government politicians say, "Oh no, let's leave this money for the next crowd to spend." Mm. I don't think so. So The budget watchdog, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, put in place after the horrors of the crash in 2008 and the arrival of the Troika in November 2010. There's a sort of annual, you know, IFAC, the Advisory Council, wagged their fingers. Now we have Professor Michael McMahon, the temporary stand-in chairman, professor of economics in Oxford, very strongly urging and warning how fragile the whole thing is. Just the points made by Dan. Well, remember, before the crash of 2008 forwards, the place was really being run on fickle construction taxes, stamp duty, and so on. That disappeared overnight, and the economy fell asunder as quickly. Similarly, we find corporation tax is now the second largest revenue source for the state, and we find it dependent, hugely dependent, on three multinational corporations. And we find that that feeds into the PAYE take as well, because a lot of the income tax take, because a lot of high earners are working for those multinationals. So yes, it is true. It is all very fragile, and it could. I mean, for example, we could have a new nuclear strike in the coming couple of years. Things have become so volatile. The fallout from all sorts of things that we, you know, that we had no idea. We didn't really see the Ukrainian war coming. Mm. We didn't see COVID. We didn't, you know, and so on. Stuff happens that you don't expect, and they cause huge economic shocks. But all that being said, this government has firmly decided their next job is to win the next election.
Dan, your assessment is right. And also John is telling it how it is from a political perspective. They probably won't listen. And if you listen to what Leo Varadkar said, as his regret when he left was that he didn't spend enough, that they didn't invest more. Would that make you even more concerned that the road they're going down could lead us to more trouble in the short to medium term?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a whole number of this, and John picked up very well on a point that I hear in my notes here, that just three companies account for about $10 billion in corporation tax. Now, let's just assume that each one of those companies is paying $3.5 billion, and one of those companies is almost certainly a pharmaceutical manufacturer, okay? Mm. Now, the guy who wants to come back as president of the United States has said very clearly that he's going to put a tax on everything that comes into the United States. Now, there is no country in Europe, probably not the world, that is as dependent as selling stuff to the United States as we are, particularly pharmaceutical products. Now, if that happens, and the company here that's giving us a fortune in corporation tax and, as John says, income tax from its high-paid employees, if they decide that it no longer makes sense to ship tens of billions of pharmaceutical produce to the U.S. and instead they make it in the U.S., which is exactly what Donald Trump wants, and for good reason, in fairness, that means that that one company could suddenly not nearly have as much profit in Ireland, and we could see $3 billion not materialize. $3 billion is a lot of money, even for, you know, the Irish budget now. So even one company changing its corporate structure or changing how it does things could impact us. So that's, you know, how risky things are. So I think it's really important, Maddie, that we have this conversation and people at least are aware of the risks. Going back to 2005-06, we were too easily dismissive of risks. We need to have in a national conversation, as we're doing now, a discussion about what could go wrong and how badly things could go wrong.
John, one of the things IFAC said in the wake of last year's budget was they accused the government of fiscal gimmickry. And they were talking about things like core spending reflecting more permanent measures that are included in the budget every year. And you see that happening again. Like, they're not even ruling out a continuation of the energy subsidies this year because they feel that it might affect them electorally.
Yeah, and this IFAC they argue that the government is not accounting in a reasonable fashion for the bills that are ahead of us. Really, part of this is because costs which are going to become permanent, really, such as housing refugees, that problem is not going to go away, or the cost of running the health service. Our health service budget is an annual fiction with usually something of the order of $1 billion to be put in at the tail end of the year to prop it up. So those things are still being counted as temporary, where in actual fact, it would be more reasonable to make them permanent. So I think IFAC do have grounds for accusing the authorities of fiscal gimmickry. Of course, the other side of it is that Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue's great alibi is that they have quite laudably created two standby funds to hopefully take account for future challenges and shocks. So that is their alibi for prudence, their prudence alibi, really.
Dan, some of the parties are inevitably going to start talking about tax cuts and to try and appeal to their core vote. We saw in the recent local elections claims that the centre is holding, and that to try and assuage them further, they'll probably start throwing things like tax cuts at them. What do you think about that if a particular party was to go down that road?
I think it's inevitable that they will. I think we're back into that sort of auction politics kind of mindset, as I say. You know, it echoes to me of pre-bust when we thought we were bulletproof. So I fully expect political parties to come out and make those sort of promises. Just, you know, to add from an economic perspective, purely, you know, we still have an inflation problem. Mm. You know, more government spending and tax cuts stimulate the economy further. Now, you know, we'd all like to see tax cuts. And we'd all, you know, welcome them in our salaries and whatever. But just from a purely economic perspective, if we put more money into the economy, that's going to be inflationary. And just from that perspective alone, there's not a good economic logic. I fully understand the political logic of parties promising tax cuts and more spending for every interest group. But purely from that inflationary perspective, yet another reason to take it easy.
But what would you say then when a politician comes back and says, look, we've got inflation under control, the European Central Bank are bringing the interest rates down, we're at full employment, corporation tax rates for this year and year up 30%. Things are pretty good. The elections last week probably signaled that people don't feel terribly bad about this government.
Yeah, well, like I said, we're all digesting, you know, Irish politics has just become so unpredictable, like so many other things in the world these days. Election and referendum after election, and everything seems to go, not doesn't seem to go as people expect at the beginning in campaigns. So I suppose we'd all digest what the message is from the local and European elections is politically. It could in some ways alleviate the pressure on the current Indian government. You know, if they were absolutely desperate and thought they were definitely not going to be in office after the next general election, they'd have an even greater incentive to splash the cash, as John says, so as not to leave it for the next incoming government. So perhaps this outcome reduces the pressure for crazily giveaway budgets, perhaps.
Perhaps, but I very much doubt it. And I think you do too, John Downing. But unfortunately, guys, we're going to have to leave it there for now. That was Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist with the Institute for International and European Affairs, and John Downing, Political Columnist with the Irish Independent. Thank you both very much for being with me today.
Thanks very much, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Next week, we're going to be looking at a book that delves into the morality of artificial intelligence. And lastly, I want to thank all my guests today, John Downing, Dan O'Brien, Ian Savan and John Litchfield. The producer of Taking Stock today was John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, please email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used used those technical shape packs way too many times.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it?
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/diagram now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more features like advanced shapes, dependency mapping, and two-way Jira syncing. Get started today at Miro.com/diagram now.